So, good afternoon. Good afternoon. Thank you for being here. You know, when I open my eyes, I always think it's a bit of a miracle when there are people who are here. Ajashanti's teacher, Arvis Justy, had a house in Palo Alto, and she would clear out the furniture in her living room on the weekends and put her cushions out. And for 2 years, she put her cushions out and nobody came. You know, she just showed up and sat. And then eventually, you know, some people came and sat and things began to unfold. It was said that after the bombing of Tokyo, the Zen masters would go and sit in their bombed out temples. You know, they wouldn't put up any posters and say, you know, come to the sitting at 10 o'clock today. You know, they just went to sit. And people would show up and hope that they would hear something that was true for them. And I think that's why we show up at places like this. We hope we'll hear something that's true for us. So the title of my talk today is Human and Divine Wounds. And I want to play off a Hebrew Bible story, the story of Jacob and Esau, which is one of the great family stories in the Bible. I had a family call me today, this morning, asking to see me emergently today. And they had an emergency. They needed to be there. And it was interesting, there were some echoes of their story in this story of Jacob and Esau. So Jacob and Esau are twins. Their father, Isaac, was 60 years old when they were born. And, you know, Isaac was the one whose father, Abraham, took him up on the mountain to sacrifice him, to perform child sacrifice. The knife was at his throat. So Isaac was a traumatized child. He was a traumatized adult. And he has these two boys, Jacob and Esau, and the trauma continues in their family. Esau is a hunter, and Jacob is a shepherd. And Jacob is cunning. He's the younger of the two boys. He comes out of the womb holding on to his brother's heel. And he's kind of got an agenda. Even though he's the second born, he wants to be the first in line. So there's this competition between these boys. And one day, Jacob is just out in his field and he's cooking up some stew, and Esau comes in and he's just famished. He's just hungry. And he asks for some food from his brother, and his brother says, I'll give you some food if you give me your birthright. And the birthright is the right to be the head of the family and also to get a double share of the inheritance. He says, I'll give you something to eat if you give me your birthright. And Esau says, what good is my birthright? I'm dying of hunger here. And so he does it. So Jacob's a trickster, and so he makes off with the birthright. And then later on, you know, you probably know this story, he fools his blind and aging father into giving him the blessing. And in the ancient world, to get a blessing from a dying person was to be given some great power and some sense of destiny. And we know that deathbed conversations in our own day are powerful conversations. So Jacob makes off with the birthright and the blessing, and Esau is predictably furious, and he wants to kill his brother. He would gladly kill his brother. And so Jacob wisely hightails it out of there, and he goes and he falls in love with this woman named Rachel. He's just smitten with her. And Rachel's father, Laban, says, well, You can marry Rachel, but you need to be in service to me for 7 years. And so Jacob says, it's worth it. I love her that much. But on his wedding night, Laban tricks Jacob, and the bride is veiled, and it turns out that he's not marrying Rachel, but he's marrying Leah, her older sister. So he's been tricked. So he says, what's the deal? And Laban says, well, if you serve me for another 7 years, then you can have Rachel. And so he does that. He spends 14 years. It's real dedication. And then he decides, more trickery goes on, but then he decides to go back to the land of his fathers and mothers. And he heads back, and he hears that Esau is coming toward him with 400 warriors. And he's just terrified. He's terrified. And so he sends his flocks, his considerable flocks, and all of his family, his wives and his children, ahead of him. And he spends the night on the other side of the river Jabbok. And this is the night that he wrestles with. Is it God? Is it an angel? Who is it that he's wrestling with? Is he wrestling with himself? He wrestles all night long. And he is so strong that he is defeating his adversary. And just as dawn is breaking, his adversary throws Jacob's hip out of socket. He gets this wound. But even so, he won't let his adversary go. And he says, I won't let you go unless you bless me. And so he gets the blessing. He gets a new name, which is always the sign of getting a new consciousness, whole new way of seeing things. And he says, you'll no longer be called Jacob. You'll be called Yisrael, God wrestler. Yisrael, that becomes his new name. So next day, he has to cross the river and meet his brother. And even though he's won the wrestling match with the angel, with God, with himself, he's still terrified. And he sent all of his family ahead of him and his flocks ahead of him, and he's making a gift of them to his brother Esau. And he's bowing down, you know, he's putting his head on the ground as he comes toward his brother. And his brother runs toward him and puts his arms around him and, weeping, welcomes him back. And Jacob is just not expecting this at all. And he says to his brother, how is it that you're treating me this way? And it's a remarkable story of family reconciliation and forgiveness. And we really don't know how Esau got there. I'd like to know that part of the story. But Jacob says, or Yisrael says, after being embraced by his brother, he says, for me to see your face is to look upon the face of God. When we have that sense of being welcomed back, when there is nothing but estrangement and hatred, that is looking on the face of God. So then Esau invites Yisrael now to walk with him at the head of the clan. They're going to be the warrior brothers who are striding out to meet the world together. And Jacob says a really interesting thing. He says, you know, I really belong at the back of the line. Because with my injury now, I can only walk at the pace of the nursing children and the little lambs. Such a moving statement. Yisrael, the one who has wrestled with God, becomes, because of his wound, the compassionate one, the protecting one, the one who's taking care of the vulnerable. And that's who Israel is at its best. It's taking care of the widow and the orphan and the stranger and all who need to be served with justice. That's a real change in consciousness. I came across a great story this week from about the Russian composer Igor Stravinsky. You know, he of Rite of Spring. So Stravinsky has been composing this incredibly difficult violin line. And this violinist has just been working and working and working at playing this line. And he's given it all his best effort, and he just can't do it. He can't pull it off. And he comes to Stravinsky and he says, you know, I've given this my best effort. I've tried my best, but I just can't play this piece that you've written. And Stravinsky says, that's okay. What I'm interested in is listening to the sound of one who's trying. So that's what our life is like. It's not about perfection. It's not about getting it right. It's not about playing it perfectly. But it's about playing the sound that we actually have to make. The sound that's our sound, not somebody else's sound. I've been reading a Boston psychiatrist. Her name is Martha Stark. And she puts together, I think, in the most elegant way the psychodynamic teachings from Sigmund Freud for the last, through the last, you know, almost 100 years now. And she writes about three kinds of wounds, and I want to unpack these wounds for you, because these are family wounds. These are wounds with which I have had to wrestle. I think all of us have to wrestle. And there's first a paying attention to these wounds, a transformation of these wounds, and a moving into a new consciousness. And I want to see if I can kind of play the notes of that that composition for you. So there are three kinds of wounds, and one kind of wound is not getting enough of the good. And another kind of wound is getting too much of the bad. And another kind of wound is simply being devastated, being heart shattered because of the intensity of the challenge that comes your way. I remember a story that Jack Kornfield tells about a young girl. She's a teenage girl, and she's growing up in this family which is really marked by deprivation and neglect. It's not so much a family of, you know, outright abuse and violence. It's just a family of neglect. And what she does at night after the house has gotten quiet is to sneak down from her bedroom into the kitchen. And she feeds herself little pieces of cheese and bread. And she strokes her own cheek and she says, "There, there, it's going to be all right." Some of us know something in the neighborhood of this kind of neglect. I was listening to somebody today. He said, "You know, we never use the L word in my family. Nobody ever said they loved each other." He said that long after his father had died, his mother in her 90s confided to him. She said, "You know, I don't think your father ever loved me." And her son said, You mean he never told you he loved you? And his mother said, did he tell you he loved you? It's just that omission. When there's been that kind of neglect, there is this relentless hoping that I will be able to find it somewhere. It's just set in gear like that. And so the woman says to herself, if I could just be good enough, someday, somehow, some way, if I could just be patient enough, if I could just persevere enough, if I could suffer enough, maybe he would love me. You know this space? Maybe I could get what I've always been dreaming of, I've always been looking for. And the cure there for this kind of wound is to have this person in their therapy feel supported, feel as though their feelings, their needs, their desires are being understood and being met, and yet coming to the realization that nobody will perfectly, persistently be able to do that. Nobody will. And so there's a grieving that goes on about not being able to get in the present time what you didn't get in those early days. And so perhaps it will be, if you've done that grieving, that you come to be sadder, but more at peace. You've let go of the demand that someone give you what they really don't have in them to give. It's nobody's fault. It's just that way. It's the way things are. You know, when Jacob wrestles with the angel, with God, with himself, he's wrestling with the five great existential questions, which are, who am I? How did I get here? How did I get here in my life? What were all the factors that got me here? How am I going to die? In the meantime, how shall I live? And why are things the way they are? Those are the questions that everybody has to wrestle with. The second wound is if the first person is relentlessly hoping, you know, relentlessly hoping that the presence, the love will be there. The second wound is relentless outrage because of the trauma and abuse that has been suffered. And when you've grown up in this kind of family, there is outrage at the injustice. I can think of at times being in the crosshairs of persons who have grown up in this kind of abusive family. And what they will unconsciously do is recreate, reenact the very things that they grew up with. And so they are not only the victims and see themselves as the victims in relationship to you, but they also become the victimizers. It's both sides of the same coin. And the challenge for them in terms of growing up and getting well is to realize their accountability, their part that they play in this drama. You know, if you always feel like the victim and you're not asking yourself, what part am I playing in this drama? Then there's something that's missing here. I have over and over and over again in my life been in the been in the crosshairs of someone's anger and fail to ask myself, what's my participation in this? How did I get here? What's my contribution to this? How am I signaling to this person, perhaps even non-verbally, that I am willing to be a target for this? Unless I'm willing to participate in my own rescue and to see my piece of the accountability of this, nothing's going to change. And I've also got to see, and boy, this is tough medicine, to see how I'm not only the victim, but I can also be the victimizer. Right. And that's a stiff dose of medicine to swallow. But that's part of the imperfect music that I've played in my life. And so the third wound is the wound of relentless despair. And in this wound, what we do is we just back out of life. We just withdraw. Because it's too dangerous to come forward and risk a relationship because we're afraid that what's happened before will happen again. The same kind of, not just heartbreak, but heart shattering. And so we're either just withdrawn, and there are lots of ways that we can withdraw, you know. We can withdraw to our pets, we can withdraw to nature, we can withdraw to computers, we can withdraw to mathematics, we can withdraw in lots of kind of ways. And all those things are good and have their place. But if I'm doing those at the expense of human exchange, then I'm in an essentially defensive, protective posture, and for good reason. And if you've had this kind of devastating wound, what you need is, frankly, an absolutely devoted maternal presence. I mean just altogether devoted. One person who had suffered like this came to her therapist's office, and she noticed that the therapist's waiting room was arranged in a way that she would not have arranged it. She would have put the furniture in other places. And so she was brave enough to actually say out loud to the therapist, you know, I think the chair really belongs over here and the bookcase belongs over there. Well, next week she came back, and to her amazement, the therapist had rearranged the furniture in the waiting room. And she came in and she just wept and wept and wept that somebody had cared enough about how it was for her. I had that kind of presence in my relationship with my wife, Kathy. She was so dependably devoted that when I lost her at the end of her life, I was thrown back into the relentless despair of my childhood. And what it has taken is a village of support and treatment and this practice to make available internally the presence that she offered externally. That's when you know that grieving is moving along, when you've internalized within yourself what was available to you externally. And the path to that is only through the path of grief. Because you have to grieve that it isn't there for you externally anymore. In all of these cases, whether it's relentless hoping or relentless outrage or relentless despair, and I think most of us may have a leading note from one of these, but probably most of us know all three of these to some degree. when there is a transformation in consciousness, and that's what our practice is about, when there is a transformation in consciousness, we get, as it were, like Jacob, a new name. We get a new identity. I was talking with my psychiatrist, and he was apologizing to me for the really horrific experience that I had in inpatient treatment. And he said, you know, that was really terrible for you, and you got so much worse, and I'm so sorry that I sent you there. And I said to him, I said, you know, I would not want to go through that again. But I have to tell you that on the backside of that, I know dimensions of human suffering that I did not know before. And I'm able to bring something to the party that was never there before. That's what Jacob is able to do when his hip is thrown out of joint. He's got the divine wound. The divine wound is when the intensity of your suffering has brought you to a whole new level of consciousness, and you're walking with the nursing babies and the little lambs. That's why we call Jesus the Lamb of God. Right? He's the ultimate archetype of the divine wound. He says, I'm willing to be this wounded to effect a whole different kind of consciousness transformation. So it is important for us to tend to our wounds, so that we can come into a new consciousness. But transformation, I want to suggest to you today, is not enough. There's another step. And that step is the transcending of the wounds together. Because if I stay identified as the wounded person, you know, I'm kind of leading with, you know, my trauma, my victimhood, my neglect, my deprivation, my devastation. If I stay in that consciousness, something gets stillborn. The reason, for those of you who have been coming here for the last couple of weeks, couple of months, we've been talking about this acknowledging what's present in consciousness, whatever, in the case we're talking about it today, whatever the wound may be, and stepping back and unhooking from that. It's still there, but I'm just taking a backward step from it. And I'm tuning in. I'm not bypassing this. I'm noticing, oh, this wound is like this in my body. My body experiences it this way. But then when we rotate consciousness and let presence, let being, let awareness look at the wound, let the wound look at us, we come to yet another level of consciousness. And we're no longer identified as the wounded one. Then we've really come into a whole new level of being. Now, I think you can't skip the step of transformation to go to transcending. I'll put this in Christian terms. I'm just going to lift this up, and I'm just going to kind of give this to the divine. I want to say, in my experience, that doesn't work. It's a spiritual bypass. Right? And there are lots of folks in spiritual circles. I've certainly seen them in Buddhist circles, but I've also seen them in Christian circles and otherwise, that use spirituality as essentially a defensive avoidance from being present to those wounds at all. What we're trying to do here is to lean, Pema Chodron languages it this way, we're trying to lean into the sharp points of what's been true for us. Everybody here is Jacob. Everybody here has wrestled or is wrestling with something. So we have to lean in and be present. We can't do sort of the spiritual bypass. That's one trap. But the other trap is just to stay identified as the wounded one. You know, I'm just leading with my wounds all the time. Or I may not be consciously leading, but that's the vibe that I'm giving off all the time. And interesting enough, you know, some people will try to rescue us, and some people will try to avoid us, and some people will try to fix us. But none of that really helps us, because we've actually got to do our own inner work, and nobody can do that for you. It's just like dying. Nobody can do it for you. Everybody goes through the gate of death by themselves, and everybody's got to do their grieving and their dying. I'm using that word metaphorically. They've got to do that, hopefully with some support, but it's an inside job. When transformation leads to transcending, and this has been my experience in working with these wounds, that when I take that step back from the wounds and feel them as a felt sense in my body, I tune into that, and then I let those wounds, that predicament that I'm in, look at this presence, this awareness that is conscious, that knows these wounds. When that happens, there is this unconditional presence. Kathy used to like the phrase unconditional friendliness, unconditional compassion. And from that space, the wounds are held in a completely different way, in a different way than my ordinary, familiar, small self ego can do it. That's really to bring it into the sacred gaze. And I just don't think that any of us can do this work. We have to do it as an inside job, but we need this, larger consciousness, call it what you will, presence, spirit, great spirit, the divine. I think it's only in that context that the real transfiguration takes place. I think we can have some real transformation with good, skilled psychological work. But I don't think we can have the move to transfiguration, to transcendence, until we can do this move we've been talking about here. So the last thing I want to say today is this. In writing this talk today, I had some discomfort, not with the material of the talk, I'm fine with that, but it is just not business as usual that's going on in our nation right now. And I feel, I'm not ready, but I feel a need to address this. Because, and here's the connection with the talk today, because I think these childhood wounds, these wounds of deprivation and neglect, these wounds of abuse and trauma, and these wounds of not just being heartbroken, but heart shattered. There are things that are going on in our national life these days that are resonating with those wounds that we all carry. And so if you find yourself especially outraged, that outrage has antecedents in your life. If you find yourself especially just shattered, that doesn't just come out of nowhere. And if you feel vulnerable, um, deprived, as though you and your tribe are not being seen, are not only being overlooked, but being pushed down and pushed away. All this has resonance with our early experience. And I think our practice here, again, to do justice, we have to pay attention to the inner work, and that's certainly my forte as a therapist and spiritual teacher. But the other part of being a spiritual teacher is the part that Jacob is doing of walking with the nursing babies and the lambs. It's the work of compassion and justice. So if we're going to be, I think, doing justice to both the internal experience and the external manifestation in our corporate and worldly life, I have to just talk about both those things in here. As I said last week, I have people who want me to talk about these things and people who don't want me to talk about these things, and I'm just kind of laying it out there. There will be times when I feel it is the right and proper thing to talk about these things. I promise you, I will not open my mouth in an unconsidered way. I will try to think about this. But I think not to speak about this is not to be accountable. I'd have to ask myself, and what part am I playing in this catastrophe? What part am I playing? It's not just being done to me. What part can I play? So let's sit for a moment. So the language that we habitually use in our metta practice, in our compassion practices, may I, we use that form, may I be filled with loving kindness, may I be held in loving kindness. When we take this step back into pure awareness, into presence, into the God space, I am loving kindness. I am compassion. That's our deepest identity. That's who we are. And out of that recognition of our identity, that we are loving kindness and we are compassion, then works of justice and mercy naturally flow. So we'll use the traditional formula. And I'll just recite the words, may I be filled with loving kindness and held in loving kindness. And just saying this to yourself and perhaps seeing in front of you some divine being, some dear one, someone who wants you to be filled with loving kindness and always held in loving kindness, that kind of maternal, dependable, devoted presence. And they say, may you be calm and peaceful. And may you know yourself to be safe and be happy. And may you awaken to the beauty of your true nature and be free and work for freedom for others, for all beings. And we send these wishes out now to those we hold in our hearts, to our teachers and guides along the way in our lives. To refugees and prisoners and those in sorrow and need and danger. And to those who disturb us. Those who, as best we can, who have wronged us, who scare us. Knowing that they too want to be safe and happy and free from suffering, even as they're causing it. In Jesus' language, we pray for our enemies. One Buddhist call our difficult persons. And we pray for all the beings of this world. The fishes and the four-leggeds and the two-leggeds and all who share this life with us. And whose lives are threatened because of choices that we make. We wish that all beings be filled with loving kindness and held in loving kindness. That we all be calm and peaceful and safe and happy. And that we all one day would come into the peaceable kingdom and know ourselves free. Awoken to our true nature and to everyone else's. Because it's one true nature that we share. We dedicate the merit of our practice this afternoon to the welfare of all beings, to the ending of suffering and distress, and to the arising of joy and happiness and peace. Let's see, Christy, I think we're going to have an announcement quickly from Christy about our spiritual friends groups. Great. Christy, thank you for all your good work in putting all this together. I'm so grateful. We're all so grateful. Yes, Anne. Great. Thank you, Anne. And the meditation and inquiry group meets at my house, number 10 Peach Blossom Square on Sunday afternoons. 5 to 6 p.m. We do sort of a 20-25 minute sit, and then we just talk about our practice with each other. It's a very sweet group. So I hope you have a great week. Enjoy this fabulous weather, and see you next week.